From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When reflecting on the mysteries of life and the universe, do you turn to religion, science, both? Are religion and science compatible? Today and tomorrow, we'll think about these questions with two scientists who have opposite points of view. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project and is an evangelical Christian. He finds God's plan in the genetic code. Today, we'll talk with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the controversial bestseller The God Delusion. It explains why he's an atheist and why he thinks the arguments for God's existence are spectacularly weak. Science, religion, and atheism, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Can you be a scientist and believe in God? Are science and religion compatible? We're going to get two very different responses to that question from two scientists. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project, which mapped the genetic code of human beings. He's an evangelical Christian and believes that in studying DNA, he's finding God's code. Today we hear from Richard Dawkins, a British evolutionary biologist and the author of the controversial bestseller, The God Delusion. He's an atheist and proud of it. He says the God hypothesis that there is a supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed the universe and everything in it is a scientific hypothesis that should be analyzed as skeptically as any other. Dawkins is a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. I asked why he wanted to make atheism the focal point of his latest book.
About 6 years ago, I was talking to my literary agent in New York, John Brockman, and said I wanted to write an atheism book. And he was immediately vetoed it. He said, don't even think about it. Maybe you can do that in England, but you can't get away with that in America. It just won't sell. You cannot sell an atheism book in America. 6 years later, and I guess that's 6 years of Bush, he's changed his tune. And when I suggested doing it again, he egged me on and had no difficulty at all in finding publishers who were eager to publish it.
Do you feel particularly strongly about atheism because your branch of science, evolution, has come under attack by certain Christian fundamentalists who think evolution violates their religion?
Yes. My subject of biology is quite difficult for people to teach in America now at the school level. I think it's not so bad at university because at university, I mean, most universities take evolution seriously and seem not to be under the control of local school boards. However, there are constant rumors and more than rumors of teachers all throughout the United States being intimidated by parents, by local school boards, even by the children they're trying to teach, and prevented by intimidation from teaching their own subject, from teaching their science, the science of evolution. And that obviously is very disquieting to any biologist, and I'm no exception.
No, of course, not all religion and not even all Christian fundamentalists disapprove of evolution or teaching evolution.
It's very important to say that, and I'm glad you raised that, because it's one of the unfairnesses that religious people who are sensible, relatively sensible religious people, who of course accept evolution just as much as I do, and get very annoyed at being tarred with the same brush as the fundamentalists, many of whom actually literally believe the world is only 6,000 years old, and which is, I mean, it should be a joke, but for the fact that some 50% of the American population believe it. But it is important, as you say, and as I often say, to stress that not all Christians are of that dotty opinion.
Now, compare that opinion with yours, where those two figures come from.
Oh, do you mean the true age of the of
exactly.
the universe?
Yes.
The true age of the currently established age of the Earth is 4.6 billion years. If you compare that with 6,000 years, it's equivalent to believing that the distance from, say, Philadelphia to San Francisco is about 7 yards.
And the 6,000 years comes from?
It comes from the Bible. It comes from looking up all those begats, so-and-so begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so, and their ages are given, add the ages up together, and you come up with a date of 4004 BC for the origin of the world. Indeed, of the universe.
Do you think that religion and evolutionary biology ask a lot of the same questions but come up with different answers?
Well, I do think that, and not all my scientific colleagues do. There is a movement among scientists to say that religion and science are about totally different things, and they sort of don't impinge on one another, and they're both equally true in their own sphere. I don't hold to that view. I think they're about the same thing in the sense that they both aspire to explain the universe. They both aspire to explain why we're here, what's the meaning of life, what's it all about, what's the role of humanity, and so on. I think that all those questions are susceptible of a scientific explanation. Traditionally, religion has always given the explanation for the answer to those questions wrongly. And so my attitude is rather different from that voguish scientific attitude that there's no overlap. I think there's plenty of overlap. It's just that religion gets it wrong.
What do you mean by that? That religion gets it wrong?
Well, obviously in the case of evolution, but as we've seen, that doesn't apply to all Christians. My point when I try to say that that religion and science are about the same thing is that a universe with a God would be, scientifically speaking, a very different kind of universe from a universe without a God. It is a scientific question whether there is a gigantic intelligence somewhere at the root of the universe. Either there is or there isn't. It's not a sort of poetic matter. It's a scientific matter. Either there is or there isn't a God. It may be very difficult to decide the question. I make an effort to look at the probability. I'm quite convinced you can't disprove the existence of God, but I think you can put a probability value on it, and I think the probability is very low.
You know, some people see God as a more mystical, unknowable, invisible, unnameable presence that somehow holds the universe together and gives it meaning and expression and beauty and everything else that it has, but would be invisible to the tools that science has to investigate the world.
Let me make a distinction between two versions of what you've just said. There's what I would call the Einsteinian version, which pays homage to the mysteries that lie in the universe at the base of physics, the mysteries that physics has yet to solve and may never solve. Einstein had immense reverence for that, as do I. Einstein used the word God for the deep problems, for those fundamentals which we don't understand and may never understand. But I would want to make a distinction between that Einsteinian view and the one that says there is a spirit which has some sort of intelligence. There is a supernatural, intelligent, creative being who created the universe and made up its laws. I think that's radically distinct from the Einsteinian view that the laws of physics are renamed God. And I have no quarrel with somebody who wants to use the word God for the fundamental laws of the universe. My only quarrel would be that it's confusing to everybody else. But once we've set confusion on one side, then I have no quarrel with that. What I do have a quarrel with is people who confuse that with God in the sense of some kind of supernatural intelligence or creator who worked it out. And I think there really is a big distinction there.
Well, since you brought up Einstein, and since you quote Einstein several times in your book, The God Delusion, let me ask you to read a few of the things that you quote by Einstein about religion.
Right, well, from page 15 of The God Delusion. "It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world, so far as our science can reveal it." And further down the same page, I quoted Einstein as saying, "I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion."
So do you consider yourself religious in the Einsteinian sense?
Yes, I do consider myself religious in the Einsteinian sense. I obviously, with great humility, Einstein was the greatest scientist of the 20th century, maybe ever. And so I humbly am happy to be classed as in his camp in this respect.
Now, you're saying before that you think religion and evolutionary biology ask a lot of the same questions, but come up with different answers and approach the whole thing, of course, differently. You think that all life forms on the planet can be traced to a single ancestor, and that was the subject of a previous book called The Ancestor's Tale. Would you just give us, like, this is asking a lot, but a brief kind of layman's explanation of tracing all living organisms to one creature or organism?
Right. The evidence that all living organisms that have ever been looked at are descended from a single ancestor is mainly biochemical. It's mainly biochemical genetics and the genetic code. The genetic code by which DNA is translated into protein, you could call it the machine code of life, is universal. With very, very tiny differences, every single creature that's ever been looked at, mammals, birds, spiders, insects, worms, oak trees, amoebas, bacteria, they all have the same machine code. They all have the same code that translates from DNA into protein. Now, that, I think, conclusively demonstrates that they have a common ancestor. That, which was probably something not really a bacterium, but a bacteria might be the nearest approach to it still alive today, it probably lived some 4 billion years ago. That's not to say that life has not originated more than once, but if there have been other origins of life, they have left no descendants. All surviving life forms are descended from a single common ancestor. That is as certain a fact as any in biology.
Now, I want to quote something that you wrote in The Ancestor's Tale, a previous book about evolution. You wrote, "My objection to supernatural beliefs," and by that you mean religion, "is precisely that they miserably fail to do justice to the sublime grandeur of the real world. They represent a narrowing down from reality, an impoverishment of what the real world has to offer." In what way do you see religion as an impoverishment over what the real world has to offer?
First of all, I think I should say that The Ancestor Tale is an extremely long book, and I believe that that page that you've just read from is the only place in the entire book where religion is mentioned. I just say that because I'm sometimes accused of dragging religion in everywhere. So there's very, very little of that in the book. Now, dragging down, I think that the understanding of life and indeed of science generally, the understanding of the universe generally that we now have, the beginning of the 21st century, is an astoundingly rich, poetically valuable, truly wonderful achievement of our species, something that we have every right to be proud of. You could spend a lifetime imbibing and learning and understanding and increasing understanding of this view that we now have. It is incomparably richer than anything that our ancestors in past centuries could have. It is an enormous privilege to have it. No one individual could possibly comprehend it. It's a lifetime's worth just to understand bits of it. And I think it is demeaning to retreat from that to a medieval worldview which simply says, God done it, which is so trite, so cheap, so oversimple, so parochial, and so impotent in the face of the huge phenomena which need to be explained and which now are being explained.
Now, I think there are some scientists who are both religious and scientists and find the two compatible. And I'll give us an example, Francis Collins, who is the head of the Human Genome Project and feels that his investigation of the genetic code is basically a way also of investigating God's design, that the genetic code is an example of God's intricate design.
It's so superfluous, isn't it? I mean, here we have a beautiful explanation for how life comes about, starting from simple beginnings, and that makes God redundant. And then Francis Collins and others want to smuggle God back in and say, oh, well, natural selection was God's way of doing it. In what that's saying is that God the designer chose as his method of design a method which would look exactly as though he wasn't there. He chose a method which would make him himself redundant. He chose the method that made him superfluous. Why bother to postulate him at all in that case?
My guest is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the bestseller The God Delusion. We'll talk more with Dawkins after a break, and tomorrow we'll talk with scientist and evangelical Christian Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project, about why he finds faith and science compatible. This is Fresh Air. We try to talk about religion from every perspective on Fresh Air, including atheism. Our goal never is to proselytize. It's to understand the different religions of the world, analyze how religion has shaped world history, and consider why some people have faith and others don't. You know, sometimes the best way to get big ratings and lots of advertising dollars is to get guests with opposing views fighting with each other. The kind of reflection that you've become accustomed to on public radio is possible because we're listener-supported. If you want to support that kind of reflection on the radio, the best way to do it is to call with a pledge to your station. Thank you. My guest is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. He's an atheist who finds science and a belief in God incompatible. He's the author of the bestseller, The God Delusion. You feel a sense of awe from science and from trying to get to the bottom of what science has to tell us about the history of the world and every creature on it. Now, some people would argue that science can help explain how the species evolved, but it can't give meaning to existence. That only religion is the kind of the worldview, the lens that you can see life and the world through, that is inherently about giving meaning to life and existence. How would you answer that?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that the universe doesn't owe us meaning. There's no reason why there should be any meaning. It might be comforting if there is. It might be consoling. It would be nice to think that there's meaning in everything. But we are not owed meaning. If there isn't any meaning, there isn't any meaning, and that's just tough. However, you can make your own meaning in two different ways. One way is a personal one, and each one of us living our lives can give our lives meaning. Our lives may have meaning in terms of the work that we do, the art that we create, the music that we create, the science that we do, all our family life, our love for our spouse or our children, our love for nature, our love for some sport. There are all sorts of ways in which we can give our own lives meaning. That's the personal way, and that's the first way. The second way is that we can give meaning to life in a scientific sense, where we actually say the meaning of life is, and I've tried to do this in many of my books, such as The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, the meaning of life is how we understand, how we interpret the existence of life. It's due to evolution. It's due to natural selection. Natural selection favors certain things and not other things. We develop a deep and satisfying understanding of the meaning of life in that scientific sense. Similarly, cosmologists may develop the meaning of their own subject. Geologists may develop a meaning of their own subject. These are very worthwhile, and they give life richness. But I return to my initial point. Even if you are not satisfied by those things, even if you feel there's got to be some more detailed meaning, there is absolutely no reason why there should be. The universe, as I said, does not owe us meaning.
As you point out in your book, religion is ubiquitous. So where do you think it comes from? As you point out in your book, everybody has their favorite theory about that. What's yours?
Yes, it is ubiquitous, at least anthropologically speaking. Every culture seems to have something equivalent to religion. Not every individual has, and that I think is important. So it's not ubiquitous in that sense. I think it's not that difficult to see why ideas which are appealing are ones that people hold. Ideas like life after death are very appealing, and it does seem to be a psychological weakness among humans to believe things that they would like to be true, even if there's no evidence for them. And quite often when I'm having discussions or arguments with people, they will say, oh, but I couldn't bear to believe that there's no God. I couldn't bear to, I mean, but life just wouldn't be worth living if there was no life after death or something like that. And as though that was a reason for believing it. And I think for them it really is a reason for believing in it. They can't see the difference between something for which you believe because there's evidence for it and something which you believe because it would be nice if it were true. Well, unfortunately, there are many things that would be nice but aren't true. But this does seem to be the case that the human psychology does suffer from this weakness, and so that would be one approach to explaining it. I have various approaches to it. I'm one of those, and there are quite a lot of people now in biologists who believe that religion evolved not because it had a Darwinian advantage itself, but because it is a byproduct of psychological dispositions which had an advantage. And I suppose this psychological disposition, one example of that psychological disposition is the one I've just mentioned, which is the disposition to believe things because it would be nice if they were true. That's one of them. Another one that I particularly stressed in my book, is a disposition among children to believe whatever they are told by their parents or other elders in the tribal culture. So I think there is a genuinely good Darwinian advantage in children believing what they're told, because life is perilous and human children are very vulnerable. And by far the best way for a child to decide what's the best thing to do under many circumstances is to listen to your parents. So I'm suggesting that natural selection, Darwinian selection, built into child brains, the rule, believe whatever your parents tell you. And that's why children don't jump into fires and don't jump into the sea when they might get drowned, or that kind of thing. You obey your parents. But if you have a built-in rule that says, believe your parents, believe whatever your parents tell you, that rule has no way of distinguishing good advice, like don't jump in the fire, from bad advice, like do a rain dance in order to make the rains come.
Richard Dawkins is the author of The God Delusion. He'll be back in the second half of Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins about why he's an atheist and finds science and religion incompatible. He's the author of the bestseller, The God Delusion.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Intuition by novelist Allegra Goodman, about workplace intrigue and ardor in a Cambridge science lab. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. In his bestseller, The God Delusion, he writes about why he's an atheist and why he thinks science is incompatible with a belief in God. Dawkins is a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. Now, in trying to investigate the probability that a God exists through the lens that you have, which is evolutionary biology, you say any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only at the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. In other words, what you're saying there, if there was a being as intelligent as God, that God would have had to emerge at the end of evolution, not the very beginning of it. Would you explain your thinking on that a little bit more?
Yes, that's the fundamental consciousness raising that I think Darwinian evolution gives us. If it were ever shown that life on this planet was designed, if somebody came up with unequivocal evidence, say that bacterial life was artificially designed on this planet, then I would say how tremendously exciting. Who was the designer? It must have been some extraterrestrial intelligence, perhaps following Francis Crick's slightly jokey suggestion of directed panspermia. He suggested that life might have been seeded on Earth in the nose cone of a rocket sent from a distant civilization that wanted to spread its form of life around the universe. The point I'm making is that if there is a designer of life, the very nature of the argument says that that designer has to be immensely complicated, immensely intelligent, immensely improbable statistically, and therefore cannot just have happened, cannot just suddenly spring into existence de novo. It must have evolved by the same slow, gradual process as we have seen in life on this Earth. So if life was created on this planet by deliberate design, then the designer must have evolved somewhere else in the universe as the end product of, or as a late product of, some kind of evolutionary process, probably a very different kind of evolutionary process, but some kind of incremental process that moves step by step from simplicity to complexity. Now, I don't really believe that's happened on this planet. I don't think Francis Crick did either. I believe that life did originate on this planet as a simple beginning by processes that we can, what we shall eventually understand, lying within the laws of chemistry, which kick-started the process of evolution by natural selection, which then went on its upward way by its slow, steady, incremental process, producing greater complexity, greater elegance, greater diversity, until it culminated in the mammals and birds and trees and things that we see today.
So in that sense, you find the idea of an intelligent God incompatible with the concept of evolution. No, go ahead.
Well, put it this way, at least it's incompatible with the kind of argument which creationists put forward. The favorite argument of creationists is, how could you possibly explain the chance existence of something like an eye or a brain? And of course you can't. You have to have a gradual, slow, incremental process to do it. And by the very same token, God would have to have the same kind of explanation. You can't use the argument on the one hand to say, well, eyes can't have evolved, and on the other hand, use the argument to say God, evade the argument, which will say God can't have just happened. What I want to say is that God indeed can't have just happened. If there are gods in the universe, they must be the end product of slow incremental processes. If there are beings in the universe that we would treat as gods if we met them, because they very likely may be so much more advanced than us, that we would worship them almost as gods, but they must have come about by an incremental process, gradually.
If you look at, like, the human sense of morality, can you ask the question, why haven't we evolved more morally as human beings? I mean, we still have wars, and there's still, like, violence and rape and decapitation and all of that.
Well, I mean, I think in a way the question's the other way around. If you look at the selfish gene view of life, the question rather is, why are we as moral as we are? And we are actually quite surprisingly moral compared to what you might naively expect on a Darwinian nature red in tooth and claw view. On a naive Darwinian view, we should behave morally towards our close relatives, our offspring, our grandchildren, our cousins and brothers and things, but not towards just anybody. Similarly, we should behave morally towards other individuals whom we recognize as likely to encounter us again and again through life, who therefore may be in a position to reciprocate, to pay back the favor. Now, there are good Darwinian accounts of both those kinds of altruism, which I suppose is a kind of proto-morality. But we are faced with a problem of why we are as moral as we are towards non-relatives and towards perfect strangers, indeed members of other species, whom we're never going to meet again and who have no opportunity to reciprocate. And that, I think, is a kind of mistaken byproduct, a mistake which I thoroughly approve of, by the way. It's a blessed mistake. But I think that we are programmed by our Darwinian past from a time when our ancestors lived in small groups, when every member of the group in which you lived would have been a clan member, would have been a cousin of some sort or closer, and every member of every person that you meet would be a clan member who you would meet again and again and who might therefore reciprocate. And so the rule of thumb was built into our ancestral brains: be nice to everyone you meet, behave morally towards everyone you meet. Now, that rule of thumb goes on being played out now, even though we no longer live in these small bands.
My guest is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the bestseller The God Delusion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Dawkins. He is the author of the bestseller, The God Delusion, about why he's an atheist and why he doesn't believe in religion. He's a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford and has written several books about evolution. Were you brought up with religion?
I had a mildly Anglican upbringing. I went to Church of England schools and went to chapel each week and learned the scriptures. But it wasn't rammed down my throat.
Do you think that your worldview was shaped by religion? I'm assuming it was Anglican?
Yes, Anglican. Well, I am a product of a Christian culture. I mean, the literature that we all of us imbibe is heavily laden with biblical references. And for that reason, I think it's important that children should not neglect the Bible. I think they should be taught the Bible as a work of literature. And in the King James Version, it's a very fine work of literature. Otherwise, you can't appreciate the culture in which you're brought up. So much of the art, so much of the music, so much of the literature of our culture, both in Britain and America and Europe, is thoroughly shot through with Christianity, and we can't avoid that.
When did you start to question religion?
At the age of about 9, I became conscious of the fact that there were lots of different religions and they couldn't all be right, and that it was an accident that I happened to have been brought up in a Christian culture. So that set me towards a path of skepticism. I then reverted to Christianity and got confirmed into the Church of England at the age of about 13, and then finally lost my faith at the age of about 16 when I discovered the wondrously powerful Darwinian explanation for life, because by that time the argument from design was the only argument that still seemed at all convincing to me. And when I discovered that it was not convincing, that just about wrapped it up for God, as Douglas Adams said.
What do you mean the argument for design?
Oh, the argument that says that living things are so beautifully elegant that they look as though they've been designed, therefore there must have been a designer.
That there must be a God because things are so intricate and beautiful.
Yeah, yes, and it's that argument that Darwin blew out of the water in 1859. Actually, I mean, it was always a bad argument philosophically, even before Darwin came along, but it was nevertheless such a powerful argument that although it was philosophically unrespectable, people went on being persuaded by it, and I was still persuaded by it until I understood what Darwin had said and done.
One of the most common criticisms that I've read about your book, The God Delusion, is that in criticizing religion and religious zealotry, that you've become a zealot for atheism. Do you think that that's a fair criticism?
Well, I do feel passionately, and my passion does match the passion of religious zealots and fundamentalists. However, there are different reasons for passion. I'm passionate about things because I've looked at the evidence, and the evidence is massively convincing. Religious zealots, fundamentalists, are passionate the other way, not because they've looked at evidence, but because they've looked at the Bible. That's a very different thing. And there are There's plenty of evidence that the reason why people who are religious believe what they do is nothing to do with having looked at real evidence. It's because they've been brought up in a certain way, they've read certain holy books, they've listened to certain authorities. And so I vigorously repudiate the charge of being a zealot or a fundamentalist. I accept the charge of being passionate, but it's passionate for a very good reason. I've looked at the evidence.
You hosted a TV series on Channel 4 in England called The Root of All Evil that was about religion. Do you see religion as being dangerous and as being the root of all evil?
I don't see religion as being the root of all evil. I had a long-running fight with Channel 4, who were very keen to call it Root of All Evil. I was extremely keen not to call it Root of All Evil. And this has been a cross that I've had to bear ever since, because ever since then, people have accused me of going around saying religion is the root of all evil. So that was just an unfortunate disagreement that I had with Channel 4. I think religion is the root of quite a lot of evil, but that's not a very catchy title for a television program. I don't want to claim that religion is responsible for all the wars in history. That's manifestly not the case. It's not responsible for all the persecution in history. That's manifestly not the case. It's responsible for a fair number. I'm not interested in going down through history making lists of people who are religious and did horrible things and totting them up. I don't think that's a very good way to proceed. I think it's much better to ask a more general question. Would we expect that religious faith might have bad or good consequences in general? And I think there is one reason why you might expect religious faith to have bad consequences, which is that religious faith, in its extreme form at any rate, means passionate belief in something in the absence of evidence, which means passionate belief which cannot be swayed by contrary evidence. People believe in something because they just know it's true and nothing will persuade them out of it. And that's very different from what any scientist would say. A scientist may passionately believe something, but the scientist knows exactly what it would take to make him change his mind. Now, if you have that kind of faith, then if you really follow it through to its logical conclusion, its logical conclusion might well be that you have to kill for it. Because you are so confident, you're so absolutely certain that your God, whatever you call him, wants you to do this, or you're so absolutely confident that if you die a martyr's death, you'll get a fast track to paradise, whatever it might be. If I took seriously the beliefs that are laid down in the Bible or the Quran, if I really, really, really in my heart of hearts believed what it says there, then I think I might very well kill for it, because that's pretty much, you feel so strongly about it, it's so clear to you that your arm is strengthened in this horrible, perverted way to do awful things. Now, I must immediately say, of course, that the vast majority of religious people do nothing of the kind. But what the really faithful people might say is, well, they're the ones who are not truly faithful. They're the ones who aren't really carrying through their religion to its logical conclusion. So nice, gentle, sophisticated theologians who say, well, of course we wouldn't dream of stoning people to death for breaking the Sabbath. They're the ones who, in a way, are not being true to the faith, according to the people who are really dyed in the what I call faith heads.
Would you argue that although religion has been responsible for a lot of war and persecution, that at the same time religion has been responsible for a lot of good, for a lot of generous and charitable instincts that have protected people around the world?
Well, yes, it probably is true as a matter of fact that there have been plenty of good people who are religious. And of course, we all know them. I mean, some of the nicest people I've ever met have been religious, and it shines through. So that I don't think is in dispute. What I think is more interesting is to ask, is there any general reason why religious faith should predispose you to be good or bad? And I've given you one reason why it might predispose you to be bad. If there's a general reason why it might predispose you to be good, I suppose it might take the form, God wants me to be good. I'm fulfilling God's will. Or if I'm bad, God will punish me, something like that. And I'm sure there are people who are motivated by that sort of consideration. I don't think it's a terribly noble reason to be good. It sort of smacks a little bit of being good only because you're being watched, because there's a great surveillance camera in the sky watching your every move and listening to your every thought. I think that somebody who's good, in spite of not believing that he's watched at all, just simply good for good's sake, that does seem to me to be a rather more noble reason to be good.
But of course, a lot of Christians say they want to be good to embody the life of Jesus, and a lot of Jewish people will tell you that justice, the sense of justice, is at the very root of the faith. So those would be different instincts for.
They would, and I mean, I should say Jesus, I think, was one of the outstanding moralists of his time, of all time, and was an outstandingly good man in many ways. And I've got a T-shirt saying "Atheist for Jesus." I wrote an article called "Atheist for Jesus." Somebody then gave me a T-shirt. And similarly, if justice lies at the root of Jewish culture, then that doesn't surprise me at all either. An awful lot of people who call themselves Jews are also call themselves atheists, and they call themselves Jews out of a loyalty, a cultural loyalty, to an ancestral tradition, which I also can understand and respect.
You close your book, The God Delusion, by saying, "I am thrilled to be alive at a time when humanity is pushing against the limits of understanding." How do you think that's happening in your field of evolutionary biology?
Well, it's the most exciting time to be a biologist. Darwin in the middle of the 19th century, who essentially told us why we all exist, why the whole of life exists. Moving into the 20th century, the understanding of genetics culminating in the 1953 discovery of the structure of the double helix by Watson and Crick, which ushered in an entirely new way of looking at life. Since Watson and Crick in 1953, biology has become a sort of branch of computer science. I mean, genes are just long computer tapes, and they use a code which is just another kind of computer code. It's quaternary rather than binary, but it's read in a sequential way, just like a computer tape. It's transcribed, it's copied and pasted. All the familiar metaphors from computer science fit. This is a complete turnabout from the way biology used to be, where one talked in terms of things like a vital fluid or a life force, a sort of irreducible, mysterious essence of life, a throbbing, gelatinous life force. I mean, this was the way people talked in as recently as the first half of the 20th century. And now that is completely gone out of the window. And now we've become wholly mechanistic when talking about life. And it's a great revelation to all of science what can happen with a single discovery like that. It is a most thrilling and exciting time for a scientist to be alive.
Richard Dawkins, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Dawkins is the author of The God Delusion. Tomorrow we'll hear from scientist Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project. He's a former atheist turned evangelical Christian who finds his belief in God perfectly compatible with his scientific research. You'll be able to listen to or download podcasts of both interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. We often like to talk about religion on Fresh Air. Religion often divides people. We try on Fresh Air to have people explain their faith or lack of faith to the rest of us so we can better understand the religions of the world and each other and better comprehend why some people believe in God and others don't. Today and tomorrow we're talking about whether science and religion are in conflict. If you appreciate this kind of reflection and want to make sure there's a place on radio where it's possible, please call your station now and make a pledge. Thank you. Amy Winehouse is a 23-year-old British singer-songwriter who takes much of her inspiration from American soul and R&B. Her American debut album, Back to Black, topped the British charts and hit the American charts at number 7. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
It's okay in the day.
Amy Winehouse is a pale little tattooed British woman trying her best to sound like the missing Ronette, the baby the Marvelettes never had, the kid who idolizes Marvin Gaye and Donny Hathaway as long-lost stateside uncles. Although she puts on a bold front of surly bravado, there's something needy in her lyrics and in her canny imitations of 60s Motown soul. This gives her music a much-needed vulnerability. Here's her variation on Ain't No Mountain High Enough. She calls it Tears Dry on Their Own.
All I can ever be to you is the darkness that we know and this regret I got accustomed to. Once was the ride when we were at our height, waiting for you in the hotel at night. I knew I had him at my match, but every moment we could snatch. I don't know why I got so attached. It's my responsibility. You don't own nothing to me but to walk away. I have no capacity. He walks away, the sun goes down. He takes the day, but I'm grown. And in your way, in this blue shade, my tears dry on their own. I don't understand.
I don't mean to suggest by pointing out her direct influences that Amy Winehouse is nothing more than the sum of her idols. To hear her at her most swaggeringly self-confident, you have to listen to the best song on Back to Black, an exceedingly clever number called Rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go.
Now that is a very astute song, half soul music revivalism, half novelty tune. What could be more ear-catching these days than a woman singing with casual vehemence over an irresistible melody that she's not going into rehab, even though all of those close to her are urging her to do so? It immediately invites curiosity. Is the song autobiographical? Is it a put-on? More to the point, as music, it's Phil Spector meets Shangri-La's production, makes rehab as addictive as the stuff she claims people want her to kick. She makes you want to hear more of it right away. Sort of sound is, I would think, a gas for American baby boomers, but are they enough to make Amy Winehouse a smash over here? A younger audience that can't tell the difference between the influences in Winehouse's vocals, not just Lauryn Hill and Macy Gray, but also Smokey Robinson, Sarah Vaughan, and a little Dinah Washington, probably doesn't feel much resonance here. That's why it's heartening that one of the best current hip-hop acts in America, Ghostface, liked Winehouse's song You Know I'm No Good so much that he re-recorded it with her. That collaboration may give her a little entree onto the radio, or at least some street cred among the kids. For the rest of us, we have to decide whether Amy Winehouse is just an apt pupil reciting well-learned lessons from her betters, or whether she's the real deal.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Back to Black by Amy Winehouse. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Meet you downstairs.
Like you're more trouble than Tony Starkson. You need to just walk away like Kelly Clarkson. I know we was free to sleep around town, but I figured you said that. Cause how I get down now, of course, you was out there messing around. I would have told you, once you go ghost, you never go back. Try GME like I don't know how to Mac.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Francis Collins headed the Human Genome Project and remains on the cutting edge of DNA research. He's a former atheist who in his 20s became an evangelical Christian. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about why he finds faith and science perfectly compatible. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.